You're listening to Oklahoma Voices. I'm Jacob McClelland. The U.S. Congress is wrapping up the year with several key bills. Last week, the House passed a rewrite of the No Child Left Behind law, and the Senate sent a highway bill to President Obama's desk. On today's show, we'll talk with Republican Congressman Tom Cole. The veteran lawmaker from Oklahoma spoke with me on November the 24th in his office in Norman, and we started by talking about legislation that puts a pause on admitting Syrian refugees into the United States.
Well, first of all, you have to remember this is done in the backdrop of what happened in Paris and the apparent involvement of at least one Syrian refugee. All the bill does, it's quite narrow, is simply say that the three most important officials that we have, in terms of domestic security, our National Director of Intelligence, our Secretary of Homeland Security, and the FBI Director actually certify that none of the people coming in are a risk. So if they've got that much confidence in the system, that shouldn't be a really hard thing for them to do, in my view. And I think, secondly, the public wants us to take another long look. Again, I thought it was an appropriate measure to do, and it was targeted, it was tailored. It was something that I think is a legitimate expectation of the American people, particularly when we do have some of those officials telling us in private, at least, that they can't vet in the way that they would like to. And I'm not surprised at that. It's nobody's fault. But you're dealing with a failed state situation, and certainly with the Assad government, a government that's been we've been at odds with for decades, literally. So it's an extremely difficult thing to do. But again, I think it's the appropriate response.
And we've heard some presidential candidates recommend only admitting Christian Syrians. What are your thoughts on these types of ideas?
I think that's not a good idea at all. And I was very pleased that while those suggestions were made in Congress as well, that wasn't included in the bill. The speaker was very firm. This isn't a religious test. It's a security test. And so I don't think that's the appropriate thing. There's no question ISIL has killed a lot more Muslims than it has Christians, although it's certainly brutal on the Christian populations where it has sway. So both groups are apt to provide a lot of legitimate refugees. And again, most of the people that are applying are legitimate refugees. But you've got a high level of responsibility to the American people to make sure that anybody you let in is indeed not a risk to their safety and security.
Now, your colleague, Steve Russell, he's a retired lieutenant colonel, and he took to the House floor to call the bill xenophobic and knee-jerk. He later ended up voting in favor of the bill, but he did compare it to not admitting Syria. He did compare it to not allowing Germany's Jewish refugees into the United States.
Well, I think, with all due respect to my friend, and I know how passionately and strongly he feels about this, and I have a lot of respect for his view, I don't think that comparison, which other people have used, is accurate. The Jewish refugees we're talking about in the 1930s, none of them posed any threat to the United States. In this case, we have an enemy that has said they're going to use this population to try and insert terrorists into it and use that as a way to get into the country, and they apparently have succeeded in Europe. So I think taking a deep breath here, making sure that everything is okay, is the appropriate thing to do. I actually think there's been overreaction by all sides on this. I think the president immediately rushed to politicize it and without saying, look, there are legitimate concerns here. This may or may not be the appropriate way, but let's sit down and have another look. I think he would have gotten a lot more sympathetic response from all concerned had he chosen to do that.
Now, you've noted in the past for a while now that you want Congress to debate authorizing war against ISIS. Do you think a war authorization debate is more crucial now than ever?
Absolutely do. I've never doubted, frankly, that we've allowed the administration to exercise war-making authority without appropriate congressional oversight. The Constitution is pretty clear about who has the ability to declare war. It's not the President of the United States. And he's operating under the assumption that the authorizations given to George W. Bush in 2001 and 2002 cover this situation. I don't think they do. Nobody at that time frame had any idea that we'd be at war in Syria. Nobody, ISIL didn't even exist. If the authorizations are indeed that broad, then the president can take you to war any place, anytime he chooses to, without congressional authority. I also think there's a lot of congressional dodging going on here. That is, people want to be free to criticize criticize the president without putting themselves on the line. I think you ought to go listen to the debate, cast your vote, and come home and explain it. I mean, that's what you get paid to do. I've been, frankly, disappointed that we haven't had more members willing to do that.
Have you brought this up to House Speaker Paul Ryan yet?
Well, he certainly knows my position because I brought it up in conference. Yeah, and I have brought it up to him. And look, I cut him a little slack. He's been Speaker 3 weeks, and he's drinking from a fire hydrant. You know, what he's expressed to me is, I'd like to do this, but we can't afford to fail. And there is a great deal of disagreement in Congress. A lot of my Democratic colleagues who want to vote for an authorization vote don't want to vote to authorize activity that, again, President Obama's engaged in. Or they want to vote for limitations in terms of ground source forces or duration or what have you. I prefer a much cleaner authorization where we just recognize that ISIL is a clear and present danger to the United States, and authorize the president to use all appropriate and available means to degrade and dismantle and destroy. Then he can choose, as presidents do, the appropriate strategy, the appropriate tactics, but he's got the full panoply of power that he would need, to use whatever he thought was necessary.
So you would suggest first the authorization, followed by a new strategy from the administration on carrying out that.
I would. I think what we've done is not been robust enough and not been complete. But again, you have one commander in chief at a time, and you have to recognize that, when it gets down to the tactics and specific strategy of war, that's really not where Congress is particularly good. Hearings are good, but you don't make strategy with 535 commanders in chief. So somebody's got to be making the decision as to what to do once authorization is made. That power very clearly rests with the President of the United States.
So now that the details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership are out, it's a 6,000-page document. Have you had a chance to go through it?
I have not had a chance to read it. I have gotten some supporting material from the U.S. Special Representative for Trade, who negotiated it. But there's still a couple of reports that are due from various agencies, so I don't expect Congress will get to this until next year in any serious kind of way. There haven't been any hearings, so at some point I certainly will read the documentation that both I've been given plus the treaty itself and listen to the debate, but I think we're some months away from that.
Have you been able to formulate any views on if this might be something that you'd support yet?
No, it's a little early to do that, and again, it's, as you point out, a several thousand page document. So until I get in it a little bit more deeply, I want to be careful about taking any definitive positions. I will point out, historically, I've been in favor of free trade, so these are not votes that are difficult for me to cast, as long as I think it's a good deal. And, I certainly supported giving the president the congressional authority that he needed to negotiate an up or down deal. I don't think you can negotiate multi-nation trade deals and have Congress then come back and cherry pick them with amendments. I think it has to be pretty clearly an up or down situation. And I think the people sitting across from the president needs to know, and the president's chosen negotiators, that they have the ability to make a decision and a deal. Otherwise, you won't get the concessions you need out of them. And you can't expect them to give all your concessions and then turn around and say, well, Congress now gets to change the things that were given to you. We get to keep the things you gave to us.
Let's talk a little bit about undocumented immigrants for a few minutes. Donald Trump is proposing mass deportation and building a wall on the Mexican border. Meanwhile, President Obama issued an executive order that offers a path to citizenship for certain undocumented immigrants. I mean, there's a whole lot of space between these two views. I mean, what kind of immigration reform would you like to see?
Well, they're both in the wrong place. With all due respect, the president, he probably destroyed any chance to get immigration reform during his presidency when he issued his, executive actions, if you will, immediately after an election where he lost badly. And he was warned by both then Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell that if you do this, you're going to poison the well. And indeed, he has. And moreover, the orders he issued are pretty controversial. There was a stay put on them after 20 26 states filed suit against him, and he's lost the opening round in federal courts, now headed to the Supreme Court. There's considerable doubt whether or not they'll even get to a decision while he's president. So I don't think the president's actions were supportable or wise. I also don't think, mass deportations are likely to happen. I'm certainly all in favor of a wall. I voted for all kinds of barriers, but I don't think the Mexicans are likely to be the ones to pay for it. I think some of the rhetoric there is extreme. What you need, I think, is a step-by-step approach. I think all Americans agree on border security. I don't care if you're on the left or right side of this particular issue. We all agree that our borders ought to be secure, that we ought to have the ability to decide who comes into the country. That's an aspect of being a sovereign country. So I would move with that first. I think it actually creates the confidence to do other things. I think we all agree in internal enforcement. About 40% of the people that are here illegally arrived legally and then overstayed visas of one sort or another. So to me, things like E-Verify, where you really have a good check on the employment situation inside the country, are really, really important. Finally, we all know of instances where people have been here a long time. They may not have come under legal circumstances, but they've obeyed the laws. They've contributed. They've raised families in many cases. Well, I think in cases like that, you don't grant amnesty. Nobody's talking about that. But you do things like, if you've got a clean record, if you've learned English, if you're gainfully employed and paying your taxes, you're going to pay a fine. You're going to have a probationary period. You're going to have a work permit since you're already employed. And then we'll reevaluate your status down the road. And that's what I think most people in those circumstances want. I think, again, passing legislation step by step once you get confidence. But right now, the American people have no confidence because they were promised in the past when we had mass legalizations during the Reagan presidency, Simpson-Mazzoli bill, that, just make these 3 million legal and then we'll make sure this doesn't happen again. Well, now we have 11. And so obviously the government didn't keep its part of the bargain, and we won't get very far until people really do believe that the borders are secure, that we have an immigration system that we're willing to enforce. Once we do that, then I think the American people are basically a pretty generous, compassionate people. They know this is a country of immigrants. Most of them have, immigrant backgrounds of their own family stories. They just want to make sure we play by the rules. And they also are wise enough to know you can't have a situation where literally anybody that wants to come to the United States can come. We simply can't accommodate that many people.
You mentioned for those families that have been here for a while, raised families, contributed, and having some kind of a system in place to get them work permits, have them pay a fine. How would such a system be set up? Would that require an act of Congress? Would that require an executive order?
I think it does require an act of Congress. I think the general public wants to hold people responsible, and they have every right to do that. So, I think the executive order route, as we've seen, not likely to be very fruitful, particularly in this case where on this issue the president is not widely trusted on the other side of the aisle, and where clearly it's not just a question of Republicans in Congress. 26 attorney generals, including our own, took him to court. They won. They didn't lose. The president's position has failed. The president has a very expansive position and view, as most presidents do, of executive authority. But this is quite at odds with what he ran on. And, he's been in front of the Supreme Court quite a bit. Has had a very mixed record on whether he's been successful or not. So, I think you need to proceed through the normal legislative process, because that in the end creates consensus. That's where compromise, that's where differences are hashed out, that's where everybody, even the side that loses, feels like they had a chance to have their say because they cast their votes. When a president does this on his own, on an issue this controversial, he simply won't have the public support to make it stick. And, executive orders don't last past the president's own term. So, if you want to have a real solution, it needs to be a solution in law, not one based on executive orders.
Now, Trump's immigration stance has drawn some sharp criticism from Latino groups. I mean, does it concern you that candidates like Trump are turning Latino voters away from the GOP?
Well, I think Donald Trump is, he's running as a Republican. He's been on all sides of all kinds of issues, and he hasn't always been a Republican. So we'll see how he fares over the course of the campaign. I think it's much more important to look at somebody who actually is in office than somebody that's aspiring to be in office. So, somebody like a Paul Ryan, who I think is pretty thoughtful about this and has laid out a set of principles in the past, is a much more meaningful figure since he is the Speaker of the House, as opposed to any presidential candidate in defining who and where the Republican Party is on the issue.
Have you settled on a presidential candidate yet?
I have not. It's to quote my good friend Frank Lucas, I can probably name you the six guys I don't like faster than the one guy I do. So it's still pretty early in this process, and it's awfully wide open. So we're seeing the candidates tested a lot, and so I haven't picked anybody. And honestly, I think at the end of the day, I may not in any public sense. I don't think endorsements mean very much because I think most voters have an opportunity to really get a good view of all. They have the debates, they have advertising, there's real campaigns underway. I've never heard of anybody that walked into a presidential election, into a voting booth, and looked down and said, I wonder who these people are. I mean, it's not like voting for the local, city councilman or assessor or something like that. You really know them. And endorsements are worth less and less the more the public knows, because they'll make up their own minds, as they should. So I don't see a lot of politicians influencing this process in a very profound way with endorsements.
So you won't be stumping for any candidates here in
Oklahoma?
Probably
for the Republican nominee at the end of the day. Whether I get involved before then, I'm certainly not going to make any decision until next year, closer to the primaries. And, I learn something new about this cast of candidates every day. So why make a decision now before I have to?
Now, this is something I want to get your thoughts on. Both Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio have talked about supporting paid family leave plans. Now, the U.S. is the only major economic power without a paid family leave type of program. I mean, what are your thoughts on paid family leave?
Oh, I generally prefer to leave it to private businesses to make up their own decisions. A lot of them do have paid family leave, and they usually make these kind of decisions based on the kind of workforce that they have and, frankly, their own ability to sustain that sort of thing. So government making these decisions is never all that appealing to me. But, I'd sit and look at any piece of legislation. But you got to recognize that you don't want to put people out of business. You don't want to cut into jobs. So, I prefer to let individual businesses make their own decisions.
I guess the question is, for young female workers or really for young families in general, who in many cases already have a lot of student debt and whatnot, kind of balancing that, starting a career and starting a family at the same time. I mean, do you think that there is enough support out there to let those families do both those things simultaneously?
I think it depends on the business that you're working in. Some businesses can afford this. A lot of the more affluent, more profitable companies do this. It helps them attract and retain the workers that they want. That makes a lot of sense. Whether that makes sense for the local McDonald's or not is another matter. So I'm willing to look at the legislation, but again, one-size-fits-all federal legislation is not usually something that I like, because it usually distorts the marketplace somewhere.
Now, you worked with former Speaker John Boehner, and you also supported the new Speaker, Paul Ryan. How do you feel he's been handling the job so far?
I think he's off to a terrific start. I think the generational change and the stylistic change were both important and advantageous. Paul's an exceptionally attractive guy. Of course, he's married into an Oklahoma family. I like to call him, he's not Oklahoma's favorite son, but he's certainly his favorite son-in-law. I mean, he's just a great guy. He's here a lot. He was here actually for the OU-TCU game. This weekend, he was texting me. I was in Washington negotiating the Labor H bill, and he says, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm here doing my job." And he said, "Oh, I feel terrible about that, but Boomer Sooner." Obviously, he's got very close ties to this state, and that's an advantage for us. But I think beyond that, he's an exceptional individual. Look, this is a guy that's probably had more to do with changing and defining Republican thinking on fiscal policy, taxes, trade, than anybody in the last decade. He's chaired two very significant committees in the House, the Budget and Ways and Means. He obviously was the vice presidential nominee for our party. He's passed four budgets through the House. He's shown the ability to work across the aisle. The Ryan Murray budget deal of 2013 bought us a couple years of budget stability. He worked with the president to give him trade promotion authority after running against him in 2012. I thought it actually said a lot of good things about both the president and Paul Ryan to show their ability to put aside their election year differences and work together on a very significant piece of legislation. He voted for the recent budget deal, which was a tough vote, but the right vote, in my opinion, and his leadership there was extremely important. So I just have a lot of faith in Paul Ryan. I know him to be an exceptionally fine person. He did not want this job, which actually makes him that much more attractive. And I think that much more effective, because he can literally look at any Republican and say, "Hey, guys, you know, I didn't want to do this, but I did it for the team. Now I need your help." So it puts him in a position to ask for some support in a way that probably Boehner, after, you know, 5 years as Speaker, and after would have been four more years as Republican leader, probably didn't have quite that same level of moral authority. I mean, you build up some scar tissue in this job, and John had some. Paul starts, with a clean slate and with a lot of goodwill in the bank, so to speak.
I want to change topics here just a little bit. Where do you stand on support for tax incentives for renewable energies like wind and solar right now?
Generally in favor. I've actually had legislation of my own on small wind power plants or generators, tax credits that I tried to get passed when we were in the majority in 2006. Wasn't able to do it, but worked with Earl Blumenauer from Oregon to get it passed and incorporated a larger Democratic bill in 2008. I've been a pretty consistent proponent of tax credits for wind power. Continue to hold that view. Now they can be phased out at some point, but I think when people make tremendous investments, I mean, I was just recently at a wind farm dedication here in the district by a European country, Enel, which this is a company that now has over $2 billion worth of investments in the state of Oklahoma. And we now get about 16-17% of our electricity in Oklahoma is from wind power. So there's a place for that. We certainly give tax incentives, which I support, for oil and gas, like the depletion allowance and intangible drilling cost deduction, both of which I think were very important in giving us a measure of energy security and independence led to the fracking revolution, if you will. So these things have merit. And so, again, I'm broadly supportive. I'm willing to look at phasing them out over time. But I certainly have no complaints about the tax credits that have been given that so far.
Well, let's talk a little bit about oil and gas and about induced earthquakes, man-made earthquakes that have really been shaking Oklahoma for the past few years. Do you feel like that enough has been done here locally to stop the shaking, to stop some of these earthquakes?
I think we're getting there. I think, look, this is a new area, and it's really not the the drilling and the fracking, it's evidently the injection wells, the disposal of wastewater, if you will, in geologically suspect faults. I mean, this doesn't happen everywhere that there's fracking. So we clearly, we're probably slow to understand this, but the Corporation Commission, the Governor's Office, and the energy industry itself are anxious to look into this and figure out ways. So I think we're starting to understand and change it. Again, if I look at the energy industry, there's no question in my mind how much Oklahoma's gotten from oil and gas over well over a century, how much wealth it's created, what a driver it is in our economy. So I think you learn how to use things more responsibly. We farm a lot better today than we did 100 years ago, too. We don't have our topsoil all blowing away. So, again, I think you learn things over time. You incorporate what you learn, but you don't give up on using the resource.
Now, Oklahoma teachers are facing low pay and several years without raises. We know University of Oklahoma President David Boren has proposed a penny sales tax to raise more funds for education. And I'm just kind of wondering, what are your thoughts?
I learned a long time ago to stay out of state issues, and I have more than I can handle it federally, so I don't have a public position on that. There's no question that. There is, because of our tax structure, a shortage of educational funding. I mean, we're paying our teachers 48th or 9th. We're in the mid-30s in terms of per capita income. Those things ought to be closer together. Part of our problem is, and I'm not recommending we change it, but we have one of the lowest property taxes in the state. And we put a lot of the support for common education at the state level where other people spread it out more broadly across the political spectrum. Same time, we limit our cities, and they rely heavily on sales taxes. So most of them get over half their income from sales taxes. So I can understand their hesitation if you're in municipal government, Tulsa or Oklahoma City, and you look at maps in Oklahoma City or Vision 2525 in Tulsa, you're thinking, how am I going to be able to finance these programs down the line? Same thing with any small city in terms of just street improvements and sewer improvements. You're taking away a very important tool, and we're already a very high sales tax state. So it probably suggests you need to look at the entire tax system across the board. But again, the people of Oklahoma are more than capable of making this decision. We're going to have a campaign about it. It's their money, and they'll decide what the appropriate use of it is after a campaign. And I think they'll be pretty fully informed on the pluses and the minuses here.
We're reaching the end of the year here in just a few weeks. What do you see as some of the biggest things on Congress's plate heading into 2016 for the next year? What are the big issues that you're tackling?
Well, ending this year well is the most important thing. And the first thing would be to actually pass an omnibus spending bill that gives us security through the end of the fiscal year and really beyond. And that would be September 30th next year. That bill's in negotiation now. I'm one of the subcommittee chairmen in that negotiation. So we're talking about roughly $1.1 trillion of spending in a single bill that would normally be in 12 different bills. And that's an enormously complex undertaking. But I think we're making good progress. We know what the top line number is now because of the budget deal. And I think there's going to be some things that we can be very pleased with in the bill. But it's got to be done, and it will be controversial. It will be a major compromise between a Democratic administration and a Republican Congress, with the Senate in particular, and Democrats in the House as well, but Democrats in the Senate having a lot to say about it. So, anybody that's expecting complete victory on either side is going to be very disappointed. But I think we can get to a good place. Cybersecurity bill, again, both houses have passed. We're in negotiation. That will be huge given what an important part of our security that's become in recent years. So we're going to end with a really significant burst of legislative activity here at the end of the year. So that's the first thing. Next year, I think because we already have the top line numbers in the budget deal, we'll see a return of what's called regular order, where all 12 appropriations bills come to the floor. I think you'll see Ryan laying out a really bold agenda in terms of tax reform and in terms of entitlement reform. I think whether or not those can get done, I think, is problematical. The president will be in his last year. It's very difficult during a presidential year with a president in their last year to get big things done. There's a tendency in Congress to want to wait and see who the new president's going to be and what direction they'll want to go, and each side will make calculations about that. So I would expect next year to be a rather quiet year where it's basic blocking and tackling, so to speak, of governance done, and where the major crises are apt to be foreign. I would hope that we go ahead and vote on an authorization for the use of military force. I think that's important for both this president and the next president for the reasons I stated earlier. Beyond that, we need to look at some tax reform at the corporate level to try and keep this process of inversions, the movement of American companies overseas to tax havens from gathering steam. When you're losing companies like Pfizer to Ireland because the tax rate's lower, you need to rethink your tax system, clearly, because these companies are going to do what's profitable for their shareholders. Our corporate tax area is just out of balance. I know there were some productive talks this year between Ryan and Jack Lew, the Secretary of the Treasury. They didn't get to a deal, but they laid some good groundwork. This was before Paul Ryan became Speaker, so maybe they can pick that up. So there'll be some chances for some modest victories in the next year. But again, I think the next big burst of legislation is apt to be when a new president comes. That opening 2 years is usually the most productive legislative period for any president. And I think the big things that'll be on board will be entitlement reform, because you got to do something with the baby boomer generation retiring. It'll push the deficit back up to unsustainable heights, and probably tax reform, where there's certainly a consensus that the code is too big, too complex, too filled with loopholes and credits and special deals and not fair to the average American. I share that view. So those, I think, would be the two big areas that any new president's going to focus on.
We've been talking today with Congressman Tom Cole. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Hey, it's been my privilege. Thank you.
That interview with U.S. Representative Tom Cole was recorded on November the 24th in his office in Norman. This interview is available online at our website, kgou.org. I'm Jacob McClelland. Thanks for listening to Oklahoma Voices.